Welcome back to another episode of the Friends of Kootenai Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake, where we sit down with incredible individuals who share their knowledge, experiences, and stories about their work and passion for Kootenai Lake. I'm your host, Joelle Burney, broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Tanaha, Sinaixt, Shwepnik, and Sioux First Nations. This podcast series is sponsored by the Regional District of Central Kootenai and Fortis, BC. Thank you so much to both of these funders for helping us bring these stories to you. You're listening to Mirror by Born on a Wednesday. You can find more of their music on Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, and Pandora. Thanks so much, Born on a Wednesday, for sharing your music with us. I am really excited for this podcast episode because I get to talk about one of my favorite topics, birds. The guest today is Galen Schnarr, a young birder and photographer from Nelson, BC. Despite being only 16 years old, some may call him an expert in the birding community. Galen has birded extensively in North America, as well as Ecuador, Ireland, and has been a guide for the Creston Valley Bird Festival since he was 11. In this episode, Galen opens up about how he first got interested in the hobby and what it's like birding as such a young individual in the birding community. He shares a ton of interesting facts about species around Kootenai Lake, some of the best places to bird, fall migration, and what species we can expect to return to the lake during this time. Galen also shares some of his helpful tips on how to get into birding if you're someone who's interested in picking up this awesome hobby. Okay, that's enough from me. Let's get into the episode. Thanks, Galen, so much for coming on an episode of our Voices of the Lake podcast. I am so stoked to have you on the podcast. I've heard so much about you and I've met you briefly at the Creston Valley Bird Festival back in May. And I'm really excited to sit down and chat and hear more about your birding experiences, your knowledge of birding, and just like your whole experience of birding around Kootenai Lake. I'm also a fellow bird nerd, and coming up with questions for this podcast was so difficult. I really had to narrow it down because I just have so many questions for you. But yeah, thanks so much for being here and let's get into it. So at the beginning of all of our podcast episodes, we like to ask our guests kind of a fun question. So my question for you is what your favorite bird species is and why? And also, I know you've done a lot of birding in like Central and South America. So maybe let's stick to like a Canadian species.
I'm not allowed to use the long wattled umbrella bird, hey?
No.
Well, I gotta say, I don't really have one favorite bird. Mm-hmm. What really is so exciting for me about birding is the diversity.
Okay.
The fact that you can find a big, massive bald eagle, you can find a little tiny kinglet, mm-hmm. and then they can all be right there. Everything from water birds to shore birds to mm-hmm. hawks that are flying up really high to mm-hmm. birds that almost never leave the ground. That's my favorite part.
Yeah.
I really do like a few species. I love shorebirds. They okay. are so cute running on the beach. They're really fun to identify because some of them can be really easy and they can just be beautiful. And mm-hmm. some of them are really tricky. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of different ways to enjoy shorebirds. So I'd say if I had to pick a species, I couldn't, but I could yeah. say I love shorebirds a lot.
Nice. That's a good answer. I also find too that sometimes when people ask me the same question, it like definitely varies from season to season too. Like sometimes I like a particular species in the spring, but then it's different in the fall. And like, yeah, birds are just pretty awesome. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into birding?
Yeah, well, I wish I had like a really good origin story like some people do, like they saw a bird and that was the moment. I have some yeah. friends with that kind of thing. Oh my gosh, that one bird triggered it. But yeah. for me, I've really just, it just was a gradual interest. Mm-hmm. I started off just watching birds on my backyard feeders, reading the bird books, mm-hmm. identifying things like siskins and goldfinch, really simple things.
Yeah.
Housefinch and song sparrows, all of those kind of birds. And then it really started to get more serious when I got into photography.
Okay.
I was visiting some family in Missouri in the States, and we found an eastern bluebird which is the state bird. It's really not a rare bird, but it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to take photos with my dad's old iPhone. It didn't work well.
No, this is I would imagine. Yeah.
Bird was pretty far away, and trying to zoom on an iPhone never works very well.
No.
So that was when it really started. After that, I really had an interest in photography. I looked at cameras, and I was really fortunate because my parents got me a EOS Rebel T5.
Oh, cool.
Canon camera for Christmas that year, which is a great camera to start with. Mm-hmm. And I used that for probably 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
wow. And that's really what it started with, was photography. Some people get into birding and then photography. I got into photography and then birding. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything when I was photographing. I took photos of chickadees, song sparrows, everything. And I didn't know what was rare, what was common. I saw a saw-whet owl when I that was one of the first rare birds I found. That was exciting. But I had no idea what was rare. I thought Western tanagers, which are just a pretty common forest bird around here. Mm-hmm. When I found one of them, I thought I was like finding some crazy rarity. I just didn't know what was going on.
I know. I definitely have had those moments too, where like I'm a beginner birder and I also do a bit of photography. And there's sometimes when I see birds and I take a picture and I'm like, oh my God, I think I just discovered a new species. And then you look it up and it's like super common in like BC and you're like, ah, dang it.
I know.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that's so cool how, yeah, you did it the other way around, where you got interested in photography first and then birding second. And do you find, like, do you use your photography as a way of learning your bird species, like just by taking photos of birds and then taking like that photo home and looking it up in a bird book or an app or that kind of thing?
I certainly, and I still do. Yeah. A lot of people learned their birds by taking photos of them, having no idea what they were, and researching it when you get back home. And, you know, I have some friends who are really good birders. They'll do that all the time. Yeah. It's a very good way of identifying birds, even once you become really experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a photo is a great way to identify a bird because it's not moving anymore.
You can
capture it and it's there. Once you get a photo, you can identify it. But when you're out in the field, sometimes that bird only gives you a 2-second glimpse, and that's not enough time to really determine anything about it. You go, oh,
exactly.
That's small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Maybe you can see that it's brown or something, but you're not really going to get enough time to identify anything. So a lot of the time, even now, I will identify birds by photo.
Yeah, cool. Sweet. Awesome. And this is a bit of like an inside scoop to the bird world, but do you have a lifer? And for people listening and don't exactly know what that is, do you want to explain what a lifer is?
Well, a lifer is the first time you ever see a bird in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen something like, gosh, I think it's 691 species.
Holy.
So every one of those was a lifer. Now,
right.
Everybody practically has seen a black-capped chickadee.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's seen a robin.
Yeah.
So I don't know when I got my lifer robin, but a lot of more unusual birds, mm-hmm. I keep a list of, you know, where I saw it, or what time of year it was, and that's usually all on eBird. But some people keep that in a hard copy.
Right.
My most recent lifer was, gosh, would have been a Tennessee warbler in Alberta.
Oh.
But my most recent lifer in the Kootenays was a long-eared owl at the north or at the south end of Kootenay Lake.
Cool. Oh my goodness. Owls are so cool. I haven't seen many owls. I've seen like a barred and a great horned, but like other than that, like owls, I want to see so many owls. Like, oh my God, pygmy owl. First of all, it looks like the cutest little ball of feathers, and I can't wait to see one of those one day.
Oh, they're around in the winter pretty frequently some years, but last year was not a good year for them. No. I didn't see one last year. Normally, I mean, they're on my bird feeders attacking the birds there.
Really, eh? Wow.
Yeah. They're one of our more common owls, but really they're not. They're one of the most common owls to see because they are active in the daytime.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But most owls are nocturnal, as most people would know, but there are several species of owls that are active in the day, and it's often misread that those are somehow more common, because often they're not. They are just active during a time that we can see them.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, that's good to know. This winter, I'll have to be on the lookout for them. And a question that I'm curious about. So how do you find being such a young person in the birding community? I'm a young person, I'm 26 and I'm a bird nerd, but I do find that although the hobby of birding is definitely getting more popular in the young person world, it's definitely still catered towards, you know, retired individuals or older people. And you're 15, right?
I just turned 16 in August.
Okay, nice. 16. So you're still pretty young and you've been birding for so long too. So how has it been, being such a young person interested in birding?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's definitely something that's more catered to the older population.
Yeah.
But I've never found it to be really an issue. I've never found like there's a difference in how we'd act about how we'd interact about birds.
Totally. Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not taken seriously, but once people get to know me, they will, they'll start to listen to my IDs.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. I don't know. You're spoken of very highly in the birding community. Like everybody I've met at like the Crescent Valley Bird Festival, they were like, oh my God, have you like went out birding with Galen? And I'm like, oh my God, he's like a celebrity. Like, yeah. And yeah, it's been really cool you're such a young person and so passionate about this hobby. It's just like really cool. Yeah, getting to connect with you and share that passion. So that's, really cool.
The Crescent Valley Bird Festival is honestly, that's another thing that I've been a part of for a long time.
Yeah.
I first went there not long compared to a lot of the guides, but.
Yeah.
I think I guided my first year there in 2018.
Okay, wow.
So I would have been, I would have been 11 at the time because. Wow. I think I would have been 11 at the time. I always lead my tours on Kootenay River Road, although I'm changing that.
Yeah.
Kootenay River Road was no good this year.
Oh,
but
dang.
the first year I went, we had an incredible tour where we saw avocets and I believe we had a Swainson's hawk, or maybe that was a different year.
Oh, cool.
But it's always been a really good experience for me at that bird festival. And it's interesting now that I'm kind of a regular guy. Mm-hmm. It got interrupted in the middle by COVID, of course. In 2020, it was all canceled. And 2021, it was virtual. And really, the virtual festival went well, but it was nothing like an in-person festival. It's the tours are all the fun.
Right, yeah.
So I really missed that then. The Crescent Valley Bird Festival is just, it's been a great place to meet all the local birders who aren't necessarily active on the platforms that I use, like eBird.
Yeah.
That's really been a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I attended my very first Crescent Valley Bird Festival this past May. And just being able to learn from everybody, even about like photography and birding and just like hearing people's stories and their experiences. And it's such an incredible learning opportunity too. And there's people of all ages, which is really cool. Cool as well.
Yeah, exactly. I found a lot of different ages of people there. It's not just like some festivals where it's all people who are retired or have a lot of free time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about birding around Kootenay Lake. So what kind of species are found either on or around Kootenay Lake?
We have quite a few species that have been found on or around Kootenay Lake. when it comes to the lake itself, it's not a excellent lake for waterfowl, which I'm going to go into taxonomy here. So waterfowl first. There are some species of waterfowl that absolutely love a lake like Kootenay Lake because it is a very deep lake. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of food in the form of kokanee salmon and all the other biodiversity that we have in that lake, but it doesn't have a lot of shallow mud flats.
Right.
So it's not a place for a lot of dabbling ducks, which is usually what you'd expect to see on a big lake like that. But because it's such a deep lake, it really doesn't have that. That's Duck Lake in Crescent that has our big waterfowl stop. But we do get a lot of waterfowl like loons and grebes. Mm-hmm. We get large numbers of them. We get pretty large numbers of geese, of course.
Yeah, lots of those.
Lots of geese. Other birds like mergansers. Yeah. So a lot of the diving ducks that like to chase fish and things deeper under the water really love a lake like Kootenay. Another bird that we get in the winter is a big flock of greater scaup that shows up along the waterfront here in Nelson every year. Sometimes there's upwards of 400 or 500.
Wow.
So for waterfowl, we really tend to get a lot of diving birds. Besides that, on the shorelines, Kootenay Lake is great for shorebirds. Some of my favorite places are Kokanee Creek Park and the north end of the lake. In the past couple of years, I've really noticed a decline at Kokanee Creek Park in the shorebirds, and I'm not sure why that is.
Oh, okay.
But I was just this fall at the north end. There were several different species of shorebirds that I found. Kootenay Lake is, at least the main body of it, is on a north-south flyway with Creston.
Right.
A lot of birds stop in Creston, but a lot stop at other likely places along the lake. One of those places is Lardo.
Okay.
It's places like that that jut out into the lake where there's some cover for birds. Migratory birds will tend to stop there in pretty big numbers.
Okay.
So those are the kind of places where you can find a lot of birds on the lake. Because it kind of stretches from one side of the valley to the other, on the shorelines where there's no point or any sort of flat land, that doesn't tend to have a lot of birds. I mean, there'll be birds everywhere.
Yeah.
To find somewhere that's really high density, somewhere like Lardo is probably one of the best places on the lake for a migrant trap, as we'd call it.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Wow, that's so cool. Yeah, I've never, I mean, I'm fairly new to the Kootenays, but I'm always looking for different areas to bird around the lake. And I've definitely gone to Kokanee Creek Provincial Park like a bunch of times. I've been out with Joanne Siderius a couple times too. And just like being out with her and birding has been like such a cool experience. But yeah, Kokanee Creek Park is definitely a good one too. And yeah, I'm always looking for different areas. So it's interesting to hear. Yeah, Lardo, I haven't heard of that area. So I'll have to check that out for sure. I'm also curious too, you know, you mentioned that you noticed like a bit of a decline in some of like the bird numbers over the last little bit. And because you've been birding for quite a number of years, have you noticed, like any declines in bird species? Because on this podcast, we talk a lot about the changes that are happening to Kootenay Lake, whether that be from human development or climate change. And I'm curious to know, like, as a young person, have you experienced or noticed any of, you know, these changes happening to local bird species or their numbers as a result of those changes?
I absolutely have. The two places that I bird most on Kootenay Lake are Kokanee and the Nelson waterfront.
Okay.
Kokanee in, I believe, 2019 or 2018 was one of the best places in the Kootenays to find shorebirds. Any day you could go out there and there'd be some leased sandpipers, semi-palmated sandpipers. I mean, in the whole course of the fall, we must have had 8 or 9 species of shorebirds show up there. Like pectoral sandpipers, long-billed dowitchers. We had a sanderling show up, which is an unusual bird for here.
Cool.
But in the past few years, I'd say 2020 on, I have not seen any migratory shorebirds at Kokanee Creek Park. Now, I haven't birded it as much as I used to, but I have not seen any. I've only seen, I don't mean migratory shorebirds, pardon me. I mean passing through migrants that do not breed here.
Okay.
So I have seen birds like killdeer and Wilson snipe and spotted sandpiper, but the migratory shorebirds that are passing through, I haven't seen any there. And I think that's probably due to population decline. Now, I'm not an expert in this, of course, but shorebirds are a very threatened group of species.
Okay.
Because of large developments on coastlines that take away their mudflat habitat.
Right.
Like the Fraser Delta, that's a threatened area that's affecting shorebirds. Besides that, at the waterfront, I haven't noticed any decline in individual species, but there's been a lot of development there in the past few years.
Yeah.
The CPR cut down all those trees along the tracks there. And I think that was something to do with the fire in Lytton. But some sort of fire prevention measure. Mm-hmm. But that did a number on the bird habitat. We used to get a lot of migratory sparrows that would move along the lake, mm-hmm. move along the West Arm in those snowberries along the tracks. And now that those are all gone, I'm just not seeing the same volume of birds there.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And how, like, even just the last couple of weeks, like the smoke has been so heavy, like in town and in Nelson mm-hmm. and in the area, like, have you been out birding during that time? And do you notice any difference? I mean, I guess it's maybe hard to see birds because there's so much smoke, but yeah. Do you ever notice a difference, like based on like when it's a non-smoky year?
Well, I try to avoid going out during the smoke.
That's fair.
But sometimes I can't help myself. Usually there tends to be less migrants that like passing through migrants mm-hmm. during times that it's really smoky. But honestly, I can't say for sure that I've noticed any definite trends, because usually the smoke in September during migration season just doesn't last long enough for me to tell anything.
Right. That's
and also usually when it's smoky, it tends to not be raining.
Right.
So that can also affect things. When there's rain, there tends to be more birds that don't, that are not flying.
Right. Okay, cool.
As opposed to sunny days, because they can't really fly very effectively when it's raining a lot.
Right.
Or stormy.
Right. That's fair.
So I wouldn't say I've noticed any major effect by the smoke, mm-hmm. but it certainly doesn't make birding as enjoyable.
Yeah, that's fair. For sure. Yeah. So you've talked quite a bit about like the, like migration, obviously migration species. And I think a lot of people often tend to think of the movement of birds during spring. But fall too is just an important time. So do you want to talk a little bit about like fall migration, what kind of happens during fall migration? And maybe like, what are some species that, you know, make a little pit stop to Kootenay Lake or in this area during their migration?
Yeah, for sure. Fall migration is a lot different from spring migration because the birds have all had young. Oh. So there is a significantly higher volume of birds that come south in the fall than go north in the spring.
Right. Okay.
I don't know the statistics, but I believe it's something like 2 or 3 times more birds during fall migration than spring migration. However, the birds tend to not be in breeding plumages, so they are sometimes harder to distinguish, really, or just less pretty. Sometimes they're still easy to distinguish, but those beautiful orange and whatever colors on warblers and orioles and all those birds, it's not necessarily as vibrant in the fall migration. There's also a lot more young birds, which tend to have duller plumage to camouflage.
Okay.
There are some species that only show up here in the fall, or at least only show up here regularly in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sparrow species that we get here regularly in the fall that are more of a rarity in the spring, like white-throated sparrow.
Good one.
And then there's lots of shorebirds that show up in the fall that don't show up in the spring. On Kootenay Lake itself, the fall shorebird migration is drastically better than the spring shorebird migration.
Okay.
I've had good luck for spring shorebirds in Creston, but never on the lake or really anywhere else in the Kootenays besides Creston. It's just not very good in the spring because the water levels tend to be too high.
Right. Okay.
Besides that, we also get some birds like Lapland longspurs and snow buntings that come through in the spring very early, mm-hmm. but come through for a longer period of time and in much higher numbers in the fall.
Okay.
That's a bird that's starting to come through now, along with late migrants like tree sparrows that are sometimes migrating all the way into December. People often think migration's over at the end of September or October, but there's birds that are coming through all the way until... I've seen them as late as almost January 1st.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. I didn't even know that. Huh.
They don't winter very far south of us. As far as I know, they winter in Washington. I think there's even some records of them wintering in Creston. They just don't winter in around the lake or really regularly anywhere in the Kootenays. So we're right in between their breeding and their wintering range.
Right. Okay. And what are some species that would stay here like all year long and don't necessarily like migrate large distances?
Well, here's a good one. Robins. True. We have them all year long. They do not migrate. They will move around because of the seasons. Flocks will change where they are. Sometimes we barely have any robins in the winter, and sometimes we have more here than we do in the summer. So the first robin of spring is really a total misconception because I've seen them every month of the winter.
Huh, that's so interesting. Honestly, I didn't know that about the robin. And that's interesting now that you say that, like when you see the first robin of spring, you're like, oh my gosh, they're back. Spring's here. When they've been here all year. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't leave. Sometimes there's big flocks of them in the winter, and other years you'll hardly see any. And that was last year. Last year, I didn't see hardly any robins in the winter. I saw one flock of about 10 in February. But besides that, there was almost none all year long. But then some years, like the year before that, there'll be robins in every backyard in town.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Cool. Huh, that's so interesting.
They really follow the cycles of the berries. So if it's a good berry year, there'll be lots. If it's a bad berry year, there won't be. But also, sometimes there's a really good berry year and there's no robins just because it's a good berry year somewhere else and that's where they are.
Right, okay. And is there any, like, species that's on kind of your bucket list for this fall that you're hoping to see come through here?
There's a couple. One is American golden plover. One was just seen in Cathalgar the other day. I was hoping to go over for that, but I didn't get a chance.
Yeah.
That's really the main one because it's a lifer. I've never seen one before. Mm-hmm. I've seen the Pacific golden plover, but never the American golden plover.
Okay.
And really, it's not that unusual of a bird here in BC. It's been seen on the lake. It's been seen in the cusp, but I've never had the luck to find one around here.
Oh, wow. Cool.
One of my targets this fall.
Cool. Well, I definitely hope you are able to see it because that sounds like a really cool bird. I have no idea what it looks like and I've never even heard of it, but it sounds really cool.
It's a drab brown bird at this time of year.
Oh, not much the brown birds. So many brown birds. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if someone wanted to get into birding for the first time, like, do you have any advice to share? Say someone is like wanting to get into birding for the first time. They've never been out birding. They don't know where to start and don't know what gear to get. Like, what would you suggest?
Well, I would suggest go out birding. You don't need to go to a great reserve or some wildlife preservation. You don't need $2,000 binoculars. If you've got an old pair in here, almost everybody has an old pair of binoculars kicking around somewhere. That's a great way to start because, you know, I'll go birding sometimes without anything. I'll just walk around writing down the species on my phone because I just had 5 minutes in between classes or something to go out and see what I can see. And I mean, the other day I found a Caspian tern doing that.
Whoa.
Just at my school, it was flying over, which was very unusual. But I'd recommend that you just go out, get some binoculars that work. You don't need what the high-end companies have to offer. They are very high quality and they will allow you to see birds further away, but they're also going to break the bank. I use some Vortex binoculars. They cost something like $300 or something. Mm-hmm. So they're not too expensive. And I wouldn't recommend that if you're starting out, going out and spending anything more than that on gear. Because it's going to make you feel like, geez, I'm committed to this now. And it should be just a relaxing thing. You know, hey, I want to go birding. It shouldn't be something that makes you feel anxious about money. Because there's a rabbit hole of gear to go down of what you can buy. I'm guilty of that.
Yeah, I bought my pair of binoculars when I moved here. I bought my first pair and I bought them off of like Marketplace for $70. And they do just fine.
There you go. That's an even better idea.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, that's all really good things to know. And do you use any kind of apps? Like, I know there's obviously a lot of different phone apps that you can use, but are there any ones that you like the best?
I use Merlin. It's the most famous one. Almost every birder knows what Merlin is. It started as an app that ID'd birds by putting in a photo or putting in information like location. And that is a useful feature, It's not a feature I use. There's two features on it I use. One is the Explore Birds feature. So I download a bird pack. I have every bird that's ever been seen in North America downloaded.
Wow.
Because I, you know, just in case I ever see some crazy bird from Europe or something, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair.
But I like that because it allows me to search up a species name on the app, and I have photos, I have a description, I have a range map, I have audio that I can listen to. So if I see something and I go, hey, that looks like it might be a such and such, I can search that up and have an idea of what I'm looking at. And then you don't have to carry a big bulky bird book. Now, bird books provide more information, and I still have bird books and I still keep one in the car. But using an app like that is way more portable and more practical in the field, in my opinion. The other feature that it has that's really useful is Sound ID. That's a new feature as of this spring.
I've heard a lot about that, yeah.
Everybody's using it now. It's an AI that identifies birds based on the sonogram as it's recording. It is incredibly accurate. I'm so surprised by how well it works. It's no substitute for just being able to hear and hear the birds, because you can hear obviously way better than your phone microphone can. It really allows you to go, okay, look, this is the bird that's calling right now. And then you can compare it, rather than just going out and just hearing a massive jumble of bird song. That's hard to distinguish sometimes.
Right.
So if you're wanting to hone your sound ID skills, using an app like that is great. And I still use it all the time when I'm like, huh, I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah.
And I get an idea and I go, oh, right, I can see that.
Right.
But do be careful with it. There's been instances of people reporting birds based on solely hearing them on an AI. And it's it makes mistakes. I mean, I've had it tell me crazy birds from Africa that haven't ever been seen anywhere outside of Africa.
Oh my goodness.
or one time, some people hear like a truck backing up, and it'll tell you, oh yeah, this is a such and such. So of course it makes mistakes, because there's things that sound like other things. So just take everything with a grain of salt that you hear from it, because it's not 100%, just like anybody using their own ears isn't 100%.
Right. And so, someone getting into birding too, are there any like specific good practices to know to respect birds as well? Like, if you're into photography or if you're into birding, like, what are some good tips to keep in mind?
Absolutely. Photography especially has sometimes posed a threat to birds, because people will be so invested in getting a good photo that they won't take into account that walking super close to the bird, it might fly away and it could completely disrupt its migration or feeding. So if a bird gets flushed by multiple photographers, multiple places, it could really drain a lot of its energy. When birds are migrating, they don't have the energy to waste on getting chased by people.
Right.
They're on a mission. They're going south. They're using all of their fat. They're barely going to make it. And some of them don't. So adding any extra stress is simply not something good to do. So if you want to get a good photo, and I get it, I do it too, I want to get as close to the bird as I can.
Yeah.
Just be mindful and be able to read bird behavior. If a bird is comfortable with you, it's going to be feeding. It's not going to be sitting there staring at you. And sometimes there's birds that aren't feeding that will do that, that are comfortable with you being there.
Yeah.
But you just need to be able to read a bird's behavior as to when it seems like, okay, this bird is now getting a little bit uncomfortable with how close I'm getting. And don't push it. Don't try to get closer, because it's just not necessary. It's probably not going to hurt a bird if it happens once. But if everybody's doing it, it's just a big problem for birds.
And I know too, like, being careful around sharing locations of particular nests and stuff. I'm part of a couple of the photography groups like online, and sometimes people share locations of like either rare species or like a nesting, let's say a nesting owl or something like that. And obviously everybody wants to go out and see it, but at the same time that puts pressure on that particular bird as well. So that's kind of hard too, but
yeah, it's a balance, because I am not somebody to, I would never say that I don't want people reporting locations of rare birds or nests of birds. I think it's okay to do if safe practices with birds are followed, where you're not putting too much pressure on the bird. Because sometimes in really big cities like Vancouver or something, when a rare bird's reported, there'll be 100 people there to see it.
Right.
Yeah. Somewhere like Nelson, there's going to be maybe 12.
Right. Yeah.
Still, 12 people tromping through the bush to an owl nest or something isn't good. So things like sensitive nests, especially in places like marshes, there's really no need to share that. But rare birds, share away, because nobody's going to like you in the birding community if you're keeping them to yourself and they see your eBird report days later of something.
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell them?
Yeah, for sure.
It's just always important, no matter if it's been a shared location or you found a bird yourself, just be mindful and respectful of it and the habitat that it's in.
Right. Okay. And one thing that I struggle with is knowing bird calls. I'm much better at seeing them and like identifying them from sight versus sound. Do you have any tips on how to remember bird calls? Like, what is the tactic or strategy that you use?
I am not the best person to ask. Some people have good strategies.
Yeah.
I don't. My strategy is hear the bird sing over and over and over again until you calm it down. And then next year you have to do it all over again if it's a migratory bird, but it starts to come back quicker and quicker every year.
Right.
Using apps like Merlin that have the recordings is a great way to do it when you know you're going to hear something. You listen to the call, you say, okay, I kind of got an idea, but it is absolutely nothing like hearing the bird in the wild. I'll listen to a call 100 times on an app. I'll go out in the wild, I'll hear their call and go, what on earth is that?
And some birds have multiple calls too. They have like a song and then they have like a call and then they have different mating calls. And it's like, oh my God, there's so many different sounds that come out of a bird.
Almost every species has a song and a call.
Yeah.
But a lot of species have huge variation on both of those. Such things like song sparrow or red-winged blackbird that have hundreds of different variations of their call and song.
Yeah.
So it's better, in my opinion, to recognize individual sections of a call that are like, oh, they're this pattern's here. And then also qualities of a call rather than the whole thing. If you try to memorize a pattern of the whole call, it's often not going to work out because half the time another individual will not make the same pattern of a call. So trying to memorize an individual pattern doesn't work very well, but memorize like the sections, like, okay, there's a trill there. And that trill is kind of like this kind of pitch. And then there's three notes here. And next time you hear the call, those might be in different places, but usually birds will make the variations of the call will have some of the same elements in every one.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's birds too that like mimic calls. Like, I'm from Ontario and the blue jay will confuse me so many times and like sound like different birds. It's crazy.
Yeah, our Steller's Jay will do that too. They'll imitate hawks to scare other birds away.
Yeah.
And there's other mimics we have around here, like catbirds mimic sometimes. And nothing compares to the mockingbird. They mimic everything.
Yeah.
But there are other mimickers, but at least in America, nothing really compares to the mockingbird. Starlings.
Oh, yeah, they're a big one too.
Starlings are up there too. Yeah. They will, I've heard them mimic killdeer. I've heard them mimic soras. I've heard them mimic red-eyed vireos. Friends of mine have heard them mimic yellow-rumped warblers and even recorded a sonogram that matched the yellow-rumped warbler.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a serious skill. Wow.
It is. I guess I'm wrong about the mockingbird. The starling compares to it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, one thing that I use to help remember calls is using mnemonics. So like listening to a call, and if it sounds like a like specific saying or something, like for example, a really basic one is like chickadee, sounds like chickadee dee dee dee, or like cheeseburger.
Yeah.
But there's like other ones too, like white-throated sparrow sounds like oh sweet Canada Canada, and like different things like that. So I find that that is like the biggest way of helping me remember songs, but still like so hard.
Yeah, another one is the red-winged blackbird. A lot of people say it goes conquery.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
It's a good one that I've found. There's lots of good sonograms like that, or not sonograms, like ways to describe calls.
Yeah.
A lot of birds actually have their name after their call. Things like curlew.
Oh.
That's named after its call. So there's lots of species that their name, or whimbrel, I think. I'm not actually sure about that one, but I think that might be named after its call. Relative of the curlew. So there's lots of birds that actually have their call in their name.
Right.
But you don't really notice it at first because there's wacky bird names like widgeon and teal. Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. You don't really know where it comes from until you realize that, some of them actually are like their call.
Yeah. Or sometimes there's name of birds that are like, it'll be a specific color and there'll be like one dot of the color, like on the bird. And that's how they got their name. Like I remember the black-throated green warbler. It has like a tiny little green patch on the top of its head. And then otherwise it's like yellow and black. And it's like, what the heck? How did it get its name?
Well, I know some of the birds are not named after things that stand out as an identifying feature.
Yeah.
The worst one is birds named after locations, though, because we have lots of Nashville warblers here. And last time I checked, we're nowhere near Nashville.
Yeah, that's true, too. Huh. Wow. Okay, so we'll kind of like wrap up with just maybe like one or two more questions. But what are some of the things that you love most about birding?
I really find it calming. Mm-hmm. It's something that you don't really have to worry too much about. But can also be taken really seriously. Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of focus to identify something when it's in a tree or hopping around in a place where it's hard to see. And also it requires patience. Sometimes you're just out and about and there's nothing around.
Yeah.
There's just a couple chickadees and a song sparrow and there's, look, there's a robin, you know, that's the bird of the day or something. And then it also requires persistence because after you have a day that takes a lot of patience to get through, you got to be able to go back out again and have another good day.
Yeah, fair.
But really what I love about it so much is that every day is a good day when it comes to birding. Right. Some days are better birding than others, but every day is fun. That every day that you get to get out and enjoy all the diversity that the bird world has to offer is a good day, in my opinion.
Nice. That's awesome. That's such a good answer too, because I feel the same way totally. And do you ever like host like events yourself, or do you ever like lead little groups to go out birding in the
besides at the bird festival?
Yeah.
I don't lead any groups.
Okay.
I was thinking this fall about starting some sort of local Nelson birding group, because that used to exist. There was a West Kootenay birding group, and there's one in Caslow that goes out on some trips. But we don't really have anything like that, as far as I know, in Nelson.
No.
That's really something that's friendly for people who are just getting into it and people who are quite experienced. So I don't know if I'll get to it, but I'm thinking about trying to get something like that started.
Oh my goodness, you should, because I would be the first one to join.
Yeah. No, I've had a few people ask me about that. And every time they say, count me in.
Yeah, just add my name on the list right now. You'll know to contact me right away as soon as it starts up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, that's awesome. And are you going to be at the Crescent Valley Bird Festival for 2023? Or do you?
I intend to be, yep. Okay. There hasn't been any planning yet, as far as I know. Yeah, so I haven't confirmed anything, but I think I'm going to be.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Galen, for being on the podcast. This was such an awesome chat. I learned so much from our chat, especially my favorite fact being the robin. That's a really interesting one. And also to keep my eye open for the pygmy owls this winter too. But it was really lovely to get to know you more, to learn from you. And I'm sure a lot of other people too are gonna enjoy this episode, but thanks so much and all the best for your birding adventures and good luck at Crescent Valley Bird Festival. And if you ever start up a group like in Nelson or around, definitely let me know, because I will share that with the Friends of Kootenai Lake community as well, because I'm sure a lot of people will want to get involved too.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, okay, see you later.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. Stay updated on what we've been up to. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friends of Kootenai Lake. Read our blog posts at friendsatkootenailake.ca and sign up to our monthly e-newsletter. Huge thanks again to our funders, the Regional District of Central Kootenai and Fortis, BC. Again, you're listening to Mirror by Born on a Wednesday. Be sure to check them out on all the different streaming platforms mentioned earlier. Thanks so much, Born on a Wednesday. I treat you right. We resonate. Cause you're my mirror, babe.